Well, hello everyone, and welcome back. Welcome to session 8 of A New Republic of the Heart, a guide to being the change for real with Terry Patton. And my name is Sherry, and I'm part of the Terry Patton support team.
Well, this particular chapter really plunges us into the mystery of practice and the mystery itself at an even more profoundly paradoxical level. Part of what we encountered in, I think it's chapter 3, maybe, on wholeness, and re-encountered in our just previous chapter on practice, is the utterly paradoxical non-dual nature of all reality. That we are both an undivided whole with all wholeness, and somehow also very particular. And this moment, you know, our awareness tending to be located, identified with a particular body mind, has a particular role, a particular opportunity, a particular responsibility, and a particular genius. So there's been a matter of breaking free, of finding our way to what's sometimes called the witness or the divinity, awareness itself, the undifferentiated oneness, divinity, conscious light, beingness that is the very nature of all beings, all moments, all points of view, all experiences. And then paradoxically, we are also me here right now with all the particularities of this moment and its various forms of urgency. And so we bring a very real felt experience of being with this paradox, whatever aspects of this paradox we are able to fully inhabit, or to whatever degree we're able to inhabit them. If we're really getting it, we're present to the fact that this paradox is deeper even than our apprehension, that the very tendency to go unconscious, the very tendency to become absorbed in thought, all of that is conditioning our ability to be fully present to what we are now intuiting and knowing to be the case. And so there's a kind of humility, and we find our way to, wow, this mystery is greater than my comprehension. This mystery is, in some sense, calling for me to show up right now. And this mystery is not necessarily the way that I understand myself, or what this moment is, or how I could show up, is partial. It's provisional. I can do the best I can, but I don't have my mental hands around the totality of it. And that sense of awe and wonder and mystery are probably increasingly present for all of us. So I want to invite you to close your eyes now, and with all of that present, let's notice where we are. Notice the nature of this gathering, that here we are with other people with whom we share an awful lot in terms of care and values and profound perspectives. And it's uncommon to be with others who get it to this stuff. So there's something in our being that is ordinarily, we're used to people sort of avoiding getting real and talking about what's really most important. And so there's a kind of relief to come into a circumstance with others who are letting ourselves be shifted and changed. We're growing and we're sharing some of these experiences with one another. So there's a profundity to the brotherhood, to the sense of being fellow practitioners, Sangha. And so just the way we might do if we were entering into a sweat lodge, we can kind of duck our head under the flap and some part of our soul might be naked and willing to sweat and to be purified into this space. And as you do that, you know, in the traditional ceremonies, you invoke your mother and father and grandparents and all of those in your tribe and all of the creatures and the totality of the sacred natural world, Mother Earth and Father Sky, with the simple phrase, to all my relations. So with a sense of connection and care and service to and acknowledgement of all our relations, as well as our profoundly blissful, ecstatic, divine nature as awareness itself, sacredness itself, and present to the strangeness that there's also a kind of emergency that we're willing to face, and that somehow most of our fellow humans don't seem to be able or willing to face. And so there we are, kind of freed up, even as we are pressurized, breathing to and from our hearts, allowing every conscious cell in the body to receive the prana, surrender into the openness with that quality of feeling and aliveness from the tips of our toes to the ends of our fingers to the tops of our heads and the tips of our ears, coming into this space with one another. Virtual though it may be, there's something sacred about this. So thank you. And I want to begin with a comment about this chapter. I had a conversation with a good friend of mine, somebody I know from the ashram where I practiced starting very young, since when I was 22. And he was in a way that was grounded in his actual experience, kind of advocating for the seniority of this radically non-dual, transcendental nature of realization. And in a sense, disputing the soul work dharma, arguing that at best it's a partial perspective, that at best it's, and even that it's kind of dangerous. And of course, I have I have some clear ideas and senses about why that's not the case. I think there are two essentials as to why this chapter is so important. One of them is that we need to, we're story-making creatures, and therefore stories are how we can organize our energy best. And when we understand and have a feeling for an aspect of a story, we can liberate our energy more fully and more freely. Now, it's true that we tend to get bound into inadequate stories and that most of our stories haven't really served us and the planet very well. And so our endlessly being bound up in our stories is something that's bemoaned in spiritual circles. Waking up from your stories is often needing to be discussed. And yet, discovering a more capacious story and being able to inhabit it can really liberate new capacities. So that's one reason that this is important. Of course, it brings up the point that it's also going to be important for us to somehow be able to both paradoxically believe in that role, in that story, and grow into the new way of being that's captured by that other metaphor, and be present to a deeper mystery that allows us to let go of that story and that metaphor in some future moment when it's no longer going to be as useful. So I want to acknowledge both sides of that. And then the other reason why this is so important is that we really, really do need guidance. We need wisdom, and we need that to come from the deepest levels of our being and our experience. And this is from the subtle realms, not the non-dual or even causal. The information that will guide us has to do with the particulars of this time and this place. And then there's another one, and actually I was thinking of those two, but I also want to bring up that the particularity of this piece of land, of this tree, of this bend in this river, of this area of shoreline, the sacredness of the natural world, of this great white heron, of this little area of ecology, is that particularity has its analogies in the subtle, that the subtle is our way to commune with the sacred dimensions of the natural world. So all of those are reasons why this chapter is so important. Okay, thank you. I see that a couple of people have raised your hands. Thank you. Karen, I think I'd like to call on you first. Sherry, maybe you can bring Karen in and we can chat.
Yes, Karen, your line is open. And if you would like to start your video, that'd be great.
Okay. So, did that work?
Yes, hi.
Hi. Well, Terry, thank you. I would like to accept your invitation to duck my head, enter the sweat lodge, let my soul get naked and sweat a bit. This chapter 7 resonated with me even more. I mean, each chapter has resonated more than the one before. But this chapter we're talking about now is where I've been living for the past 3 years. I feel like I'm living everything you've been saying and living everything you just said just now. I have discovered the passion, the purpose, what I was born to do, and what I want to contribute very much through the process you described in this chapter, and it's always deepening. It's always deepening. Mm-hmm. We are story-making creatures. Stories are how we organize ourselves. My purpose and passion is writing a more capacious story. In a remarkable synchronicity, you know, since I started working on the novel that I hope will present integral evolution, our evolutionary worldview to a mass public, since I started on this project, well, since it landed on me and chose me 3 years ago, I have been having more and more synchronicities. The little ones don't stop. The big ones just keep coming. I have 66 years old. I have never felt more alive in my life. And my journey has been parallel in some ways to yours, but the difference, it's like the obverse of yours. I had to go deep within myself into that night journey to discover my yang female leadership. I mean, I raise a glass to the yin male leadership, but let's also hear for yang female leadership. Basically, I had to go in and wrestle with my own inner barbarian in my third chakra, the chakra of our energy, you know, that power center in our haras. That's part of the hara, which I had suppressed all my life. Having cast it into the outer darkness because of early conditioning, you know, everything that's innate in us that we cast, that we suppress, we cast it into the outer darkness. It comes back to us in a demonic form. And these are the dragons that we wrestle with. And I want to quote page 198 in New Republic of the Heart. You're telling the story of the Lindworm, that Swedish fairy tale. And you say some monsters need to be transformed and loved rather than only fought and slain. And basically, I've been wrestling with the bad guy, Barbarian, who's the antagonist in my novel. I hated him when the story first landed on me. He was the bad guy. He was evil. He was power run amok. And I've ended up wrestling with that own energy that I'd suppressed in myself and discovered that it's the hero. It's the solar hero. It's the great hero that wants to, that is willing to sacrifice everything to bring about the new era that we want to bring about. This is the red barbarian who wants to join our integral party. Let's see, I don't know if you remember, Terry, but I was at the integral conference, you know, in Denver at the new year, and I bookended the conference with these two excited burbles about how the red barbarian in our third chakras wants to join our integral party. I mean, I just really felt like he was speaking through me. I don't know how it seemed to anybody else, but this is this energy, the energy of all the chakras. It's just energy, whether it's power and survival or sex and pleasure or power or community and dogma or self-expression. All the chakras want to be integrated at a new higher level of functioning where they all mutually support each other. And this has been my adventure, freeing that energy in myself. And it's taken a lot of shadow work and a lot of humility and allowing erotic energy to arise that I didn't realize I was suppressing and letting that flow into my novel and saying, don't dumb this down. All the chakras want to dance. All the chakras want to be part of this new era, this new more integral era where all of the energies can flow freely in harmony and build something very beautiful. So basically, I went into the sweat. I've been in that sweat lodge off and on for the last 3 years, and sometimes it's been much too intense. But it's beautiful and wonderful, and I love what you're doing. And okay, I'll shut up now. And
well, thanks. That was something of a you know, like a personal testimony, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
It's often a part of a church service as we get up and we testify.
I testify. I see the light. Thank you, Buddha.
Well, it's kind of more like I've gone and let myself get disorganized and vulnerable, and the red barbarian has shown himself to be me and part of the energy with which I can rise to meet my calling. And that's very beautiful. So
I thought he was the enemy.
Yeah.
He wanted to be loved too. But I had to be strong enough to stand up to him in his negative form and not be destroyed by him. And that's that fight we have to go into when we go into our own inner darkness.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of, I mean, this is almost infinitely rich and deep. I'm not sure, Karen, if these have been resources for you, but when I've taught this material more deeply, I've often referred people to the work of Bill Plotkin, and particularly his book, Soulcraft, and also the work of James Hillman and his book, The Soul's Code, and also a little bit more complex book called Revisioning Psychology might be worth a visit.
Is that by Hillman also?
That's by Hillman also, yeah.
What was that, Revisioning Psychology?
Yes.
Thank you.
So those resources might be worth mentioning. This is profound work. It is an enormous field. There are many people who are focused on soul work. It tends to be, as I think I mentioned in the chapter, that people who are appreciating the body, nature, imagery, poetic and artistic dimensions of our nature will rebel against transcendental spirituality and kind of try to reject the awakening from the dream, sort of awakening from false identities, divination of the being that are the primary focus of the previous chapter. And it's so important that that not be how we orient, that there is something of a willingness to die into divinity itself, and even yes. to let go of our story and our identity and our particularity. I mean, that is the nature. To some degree, people say that spiritual practice is rehearsal for death. And embracing the particularity of my soul isn't how we die. There is a let go at the end of that tunnel. We let go of the soul and the story and the role and the energies and the mythic and archetypal forms, and we have to let it all go into that pure light.
Yes.
So something of that ecstatic apprehension of totality informs us enough so that then we aren't engaging all of this because this is about me, this is about my meaning and my fulfillment and my life becoming a victory. And that self-transcending relationship to things changes the context so much. And then with that context having been changed, well, let's get out on the dance floor and let's live in this real world and let's enjoy pleasure and let's discover deeper meaning and let's engage all of it. But there's a kind of, it feels to me almost like, an iridescent fabric, is it green or is it magenta, it's sort of shimmering between two states, two conditions. And reality has to, as we deepen into this practice and these realizations, it is both true, that the very concrete particularity of this, the divinity as it expresses itself in this particular natural place, in this particular individual heart and soul, is the whole point. And there is no divinity if we do not honor and love and care for and be committed to something tangible and specific. And there is a recognition of a greater context in which we also let go of that. And how can it be that my realization is bringing me down into the earth and into the particular, into love and commitment to the particular, and helping me let go into the all, both at the same time? This doesn't make any sense, and it only comes real as we continue to meditate, continue to practice, continue to deepen, and continue to awaken in a frame of practice that has room for both these dimensions of sacredness. So thank you for...
Amen, brother, and hallelujah.
So you testified and I testified. Thank you, Karen. Good to be with you here. Okay. Let's see. Are any other hands going up?
We have Annika.
Yes, and Annika's been in touch with me, and she has a really beautiful summary question that I do want to answer, but I ideally like to answer it a little later in the session. And I was hoping that one of these camera-shy people who we haven't heard from before that you may have noticed in the email in which I announced this session, I invited people who haven't raised your hands in the past to be so courageous and generous as to do that. So I would like to invite that. And while people are building up to raising your hands, let me go into something. One of the dimensions of what I explored in this chapter had to do with metaphors, with how there can be a metaphor for one's current way of being and a metaphor for a new way of being. This is a central theme of some very powerful coaching methods. I was trained by Integral Coaching Canada years ago. They use this approach, and so does the Integral Coaching method of New Ventures West and James Flaherty. And these schools after the coaching client has talked about what the reason they've come into the coaching situation, the questions that they're asking, their coaching topic, and they've come to understand something about the nature of that person and the kind of shift that's intended, they encapsulate it in metaphor. So I have shared a whole series of those, like my current way of being is a warrior. I am being strong, I'm coming forward, I'm accepting wounds, I'm forging into battle, I'm enduring hardship, but I am, you know, championing my cause, my side in the battle, forces of good, perhaps. But maybe there's a new way for me to be in my life. Maybe I could discover that I could be far more effective, not as a warrior, but as a sage. Maybe I am growing into the time in my life where my wisdom is increasingly real and available and important. And that will be the mode of being that will really help the true battle that I care most about to really be won. And I identified a whole other series, like I was seeker, that was my way of being. But now I've made contact with something. My mode is that of a practitioner. Maybe I'm the secret prince and somehow I have a secret life and there's something noble about me. But I'm not seen as a prince. It's a secret to everyone. And so I'm, you know, or a princess. And then I could go to becoming really reclaiming my inner throne and becoming the king or the queen. Other pairs that I identified in the book are going from orphan and feeling that cut off, like, oh, where is that source of nurturance? That's part of my very way of being. And some forlorn part of the heart is always part of my experience. And then discovering that, I can heal something by becoming the loving parent to all the need, to all the orphan energy that I might see anywhere. You can go from being a martyr to a beneficent elder, a hungry hunter, to a wise gardener, an anxious planner to a faithful, confident, powerful listener. Those kinds of shifts are just a few of many, many, many others. We might find ourselves in the divine romance, and I have to go from the place of lonely longing for my prince to come to becoming a fierce lover of my beloved as I transition from the first part of the story where I'm waiting for him and now he's come and it's time for me to really bring my love. And if the whole world is my beloved, then the divine romance takes the form of you being that kind of a faithful wife or lover to that prince. every moment in the hero's journey. You know, there's the moment when he's called and he refuses the call, and then he might accept the call. And then there's another moment when he's tested on the path and he has to rise to the test. There's the moment when he's given his magical power or talisman. And what does it take to assume your rightful role as holding this magical power? There's the moment where the still point before the battle, where one, the hero steals his or her intent and becomes capable. There's a way that your attention is a little scattered, and this coming into focus is your new way of being. And on and on. This goes, there are many different moments. And each of us in our life journey is moving among different moments that are asking different things of us. Sometimes what's being asked of me is humility. Sometimes it's discernment. Sometimes it's courage. Sometimes it's compassion. Many different virtues are asked in this next moment of practice. And in this next moment of my life journey, there's a particular curriculum. And because we are all awakening ever more fiercely to the urgency of now, there is a way that that contextualizes our individual journeys. So I want to give us a chance to just briefly visit this consideration with one another in our breakout groups, which I'll do earlier than usual this time around. Please stay with us. If you're someone who doesn't participate in the breakout groups, hang in there. We'll come back in less than 15 minutes. Sherry, please come on and explain things in just a minute, and I will read to you what we're going to do. We're going to do this relatively briefly. We don't want most of the session to be in breakout. We like being together, all of us. But here's the instructions, and these will be in the chat window for you. When you sense into the deeper meanings of this moment of your life, does an archetypal role in a mythic story come to mind? Whether or not it does, please consider how your current way of being expresses itself as a metaphor, and how this expression can be transformed as you rise to this moment of your journey into a new way of being, a metaphor for a way of being that your soul seems to be asking you to mature into. And then many of these pairs of metaphors that I just described will be also in the chat window. Well, hi, everyone. Thank you. If my triad was representative of others, these instructions may have been a little elusive, but I hope you had a good conversation regardless. I think that was certainly possible, and I hope everybody has had some benefit. And I hope that out of this conversation, perhaps a few more people will feel moved to raise your hands. But in the meantime, I think I'd like to take a couple of polls. The poll I want to, the first question I want to ask is, are you in a book discussion group that in association with this course, either one that we put you into or one that you organized on your own? And I'm curious to hear more about what people's experiences are. And some of that will have to just show up on the Facebook group, or you can hit the question for Terry and let me know what your questions are. Oh, maybe we can't do that poll. I'm interested to hear more how the groups are going. That's the key thing. And I also am interested to hear about any requests or any curiosities. What about this? How can I hear about your experience and further tweak or intensify or, you know, add, refine the way that we're engaging this so that you could be better served? So I want to just invite that feedback. And you know, feel free to use the questions for Terry button on the homepage and just send a message to me that way. So we won't do a poll. Evidently, we can't. We have somebody who's raised their hand, and I want to take advantage of that. Actually, several. Whoa, a lot of people. So Adam, please come on and ask your question.
Hello. Hi, sorry.
Hi.
Yeah, happy to be here. Finally, I've been trying to catch up and following, but today I'm prepared. So, my question is regarding these some of these narratives that you mentioned. You know that we're growing up and we're waking up and it's a planetary birth, and it seems to relate to the narrative that in one sense that we'll grow up into this glorious future. You know, sometimes we might label it a bit of the new age perspective, you know, that this is just a crisis and in the future everything will be perfect. And, you know, let's hope so. It's a beautiful vision, you know, but it often seems to contradict the classic Indian cosmology, I find, with the yugas, where they say we are now in the Kali Yuga, and that this era we are in is really a degradation of our human moral values and our culture in a way, but that, you know, and it's there seems to be more forces pointing in the destructive sense, in the way, you know, but in a way that's, it's not like, for me, that perspective is not necessarily disheartening. You know, my own story that I have about what's going on, very simply, is that the whole technological industrial advancement, you know, that has happened, it has created the possibility for us to sit here and share this knowledge. You know, it's been like a kind of explosion of human capacity and knowledge sharing, you know. Just, you know, today we have the world's philosophies available with the click of a button. You know, we can study spirituality that was not available to just most of a few generations ago, you know, like here in Europe. You know, it can completely open up a complete other perspective for as potentially, at least. So, I mean, my point is that in a way, usually I have this joke that maybe God loves computer games, you know? Maybe it's like the nature has created this huge explosion of capacity, but that price might be our ecosystem, you know? And maybe it's a natural evolution, like maybe it's a natural thing, you know? Like as when a species, other species also, when they get too powerful, they don't always stay in balance with the ecosystem. And anyway, my point is that, of course, growing into a sort of an enlightened perspective that we are part of Mother Nature, we should, of course, try to take care and do the best we can to prevent the destruction that's going on. But also that it might be inevitable, you know, and that this is like an opportunity to really awake to what we are for so many of us, you know, like us here in the West come from this advanced civilization, but spiritually we don't seem to be very advanced, you know, if you compare it to the East, like just being honest, you know, like they're philosophically, they seem to have been more advanced for like millennia, you know, and that these perspectives are now available to us and available to the whole world, and that this is maybe is a great flourishing that we're living in, a great flourishing of human capability of and awareness, and maybe it's short-lived, you know, who knows. This has always been my feeling, so we should enjoy it and make the best of it, and definitely try to avoid destroying the earth more and try to resist and really prevent the degradation of the human, of the ecosystem. But even if it happens, not be too, not even be too attached to this world. I went to, with a spiritual teacher, Gautam Rinchen, recently. He said, if the world is destroyed tomorrow, so be it, don't be too worried about it. It's like, I think the world is full of planets and life and dimensions and it's not like the end of life. Life is eternal.
Those are really interesting musings, Adam. And I have thought many similar thoughts myself, so I can relate. I get it. And the book, in a way, is an extended meditation on those questions at a certain level. And I think for me, the experience is that each time I let go of that intense grip of my need for it all to be saved, I go deeper, I discover a well-being that's more profound than that anxiety. But then I also discovered that there's probably a little bit of a spiritual bypass in that, and that there's a deeper level in which my love of the particularity of life and of this planet and of everything that, this is a many billions of years of incredible, intense engagement are invested in, all of that is present in us. Our bodies are, that was us back at the Big Bang. And that was us back when the first supernovas created the carbon and other, nitrogen, all the higher elements that are part of our bodies. And that was us back with the first prokaryotes and then the eukaryotes and sexual reproduction. In a sense, we are, all of that is present here. And so life wants to keep living, and evolution wants to keep evolving. And there are soul qualities to that, that just like the ferocity with which a creature or a person fights for their life, that all of that has its own rightness too. And so there's something of deepening into both my valuing of freedom and my valuing of particularity, like we talked about earlier, that just shows up right here in these questions as well. And I think it's a little dangerous to go to the place. I don't want to diss this other teacher you spoke with. They might be wiser and understand, speaking this from a very profound place. But just for the sake of our conversation, that sounded to me a little bit like the spiritual bypass that is actually a huge moral failing. If we go to a place of saying, well, don't worry about it, don't be attached, we fail to let that aspect of who we are that loves life, loves humanity, loves Earth, loves the living ecosystems to really come through us and be expressed through us. And it's a transcendental spirituality that doesn't have the imminent incarnate spirituality. Like the indigenous people who know their spirituality through the embodied earth. In a way, that's more non-dual than the transcendental. The spirituality is all in getting free of this place. But in a way, that's dual. That's dualistic. This place is part of reality. If we're really non-dual, we're arriving here, and we're caring about what's here, and we're engaged with what's here. So let yourself be challenged to keep going deeper. It's not that there's anything wrong or one point of view is right and the other is wrong, but this is a growth path. And your ability to fully live your awakening, your freedom, your joy, your understanding of spirituality, if the mudslide takes out your meditation hall and leaves you miserable and shuddering and barely gasping for breath and so forth, you'll remember, the absolute may trump the conditional, but sometimes the conditional trumps the absolute, that this paradox is infinitely deep. And you'll just be deepened and you'll become a presence of deeper understanding and greater joy and greater care that coexists with this profoundly deep, mysterious reality. And your freedom will not be cheapened by an avoidance of pain. That the really awake being is not just trying to avoid pain. That is not where true awakening goes. And so there's something worth presencing about that without necessarily having any critique of any, you know, this individual. So thank you very much, Adam. That was really good, really worthwhile.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And I must say, I completely agree with your saying. I'm not, you know, I believe there's the ultimate and relative, you know, and I'm totally for speaking up and being activating and speaking up against the destruction and the inequality in this.
Well, it may be more than speaking up. I mean, we may be changing our lifestyles, learning to do permaculture, relocalizing, moving from cities to more rural places. Who knows what it'll be? It could be quite demanding. And this awakening to, wow, there's something really big going on beyond what we can altogether see. And somehow it needs me, it needs you, you know, that's where the soul piece is so invigorating, especially to those of us who have done, you know, a Buddhist or other non-dual influenced spiritual path for most of our practice life. Yeah. Thanks so much. Really good to meet you, Adam, too. Terrific. Well, let me call on, let's see. I am going to continue to go a little beyond the 15 after the hour endpoint, and now we have more new people raising their hands than I have probably time to answer. But
I just wanted to comment about Carl Jung within the concept of all of this and where we're expanding to and what that's about.
Could you tilt your laptop so I could see more? Yeah, your whole head.
Yeah. We're good. Okay.
There we are.
And something that really sticks out for me about the polarities and dark and light and a lot of which we're dealing with in this polarization that we're doing consciousness right now. But Carl Jung had pointed out, and he believed, right or wrong, but he believed that Jesus was the metaphor or real person that was for the polarization of the dark and the light, to observe the dark and the light as separate pieces, so that mankind could fully own his darkness and then do a wholeness within that. So I sort of, and I'm one to believe that, oh yes, we're going to just go repopulate another planet or something like that. But in this time frame I'm in now, I'm very much embracing Carl Jung's thought, and then I take it, extrapolate it further, and I'd say, okay, so we're in this very intensification of the dark and the light, the polarization, seeing the dark around us, seeing our president, seeing what's happening in other countries too, so that we go through kind of like a cataclysmic reemergence of wholeness, which will take a time period, perhaps or perhaps not. But it's going to take the kind of work you're talking about, Terry, one foot in front of you, doing the proactive, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, we are all re-owning the totality of ourselves, which doesn't mean we're evil and light, but that we have the energy of the darkness and the light together to create with. So those are just something that I feel strongly about coming from the Carl Jung perspective. And I like his perspective a lot. I like
So I liked what you said. I heard quite a few things, and I know that in your own sense of things, there was an essence of what you were saying. And if you could state that in a single sentence, in this, you know, in an oversimplified way, but in an essentialized way, I think that might help all of us.
So the essence is that the crisis that we're in consciousness right now is really an evolution of having gone through the polarization of dark and light. And now we're moving through the muckiness of resorting and then moving into an eventual reorganization of dark and light being owned within each person, the yin and the yang within each person, the wholeness of each person. And this is the muckiness that we have to go through. You know, we went through the polarization of identifying dark and light as separate energies put by externalizing Christ outside of ourselves and saying that is light. And so many religions say, well, then I am dark.
So you're suggesting that we're going through a collective process.
Yes.
But it now leaves me feeling inclined to reflect on what you've said, Pam. But maybe even as humanity as a whole, or at least the civilized aspect of humanity, I'm not sure if indigenous people, if this can, is also true of them, but as we have gone into this dualism and we've identified a pure light and a pure darkness and we've divided them, we're having to go through a return of all, everything repressed and a reemergence of everything darkest in us in order that there might be a social level of integration. If that's the case, it's going to be kind of a messy process, and it's going to need a lot of individuals who've gone through this process in themselves as wisdom holders for it. So those of us who have done some of this have something to bring, and perhaps each of us has an opportunity to even more profoundly integrate these different dimensions of ourselves, because a profound level of psychic integration and leadership is likely to be needed.
Yes. Yeah. I agree with you totally, yes.
Yeah, thank you. Let's take one more question before we go to Annika. Annika has a great question. I don't think we've heard from Stuart here yet. So welcome, Stuart. Hi.
Thank you. I'm calling from the UK, from the southwest of England, from the town of Totnes, which we have the transition movement and Martin Shaw and the Dark Mountain Project, all this kind of soul work, which you've pointed to, which has been really helpful to me personally. So feedback to yourself, the resources that you share over time and on your email list have been wonderful. Things you've pointed to and the things you've hit me over the head with sometimes, certainly to do with climate change and your interviews with various people. So my specific point is to do with your recent sharing of resources to do with the Listening Society book.
Yeah. Yes.
And I've just started reading it, and it's powerful stuff. It's a interesting new vehicle for the meta modernism viewpoint or stage of development. And he's provoking an activist in me, or he's giving me a bit of a duffing up, wherein he's a critique of integral being an observing tribe. And he's saying, you know, like, was it Clinton or Bush said, it's the economy stupid. It's economic stupid. And he's saying it's development stupid. Evolve or die. In a very provocative kind of way. And I'm curious as to why you've chosen to point us in the direction of the book and what you're seeing in that book.
Well, there are a number of things that I see in that book that I'm very excited about. And I can't do full justice to it and still take Annika's question. So I'm going to provide a kind of a essentialized answer to that question. Metamodernism is, number one, in my opinion, it's just another expression of integral consciousness, and it's just decided to do its own thing and not have to be located inside the conversation that calls itself integral. And therefore, it's liberated to do it in new and different ways. And I see a lot of fresh, new energy there. And I see some of it in the book, The Listening Society, but I see other expressions of it in... I don't know if you've encountered the alternative UK, but there's a political platform, and it is not exactly the same people. These people know one another, I think, but it has its own genius and its own particular focus that's got more to do with what transition towns, you know, the kind of a relocalization focus. And so what for me is going on is that I'm so overjoyed to see the integral impulse expressing itself more than I thought. I was having the experience, even during the days of finishing the writing of this book, of seeing the integral movement seeming to become less dynamic. And that was of concern to me. Now, by no means is it, the integral movement has a lot to it, and it's by no means on death's door or anything. I went to the integral conference, your integral European conference in Hungary this May, and it was 600 people. It was, you know, there's a lot going on and a lot of really original and valuable work. But what I think the metamodernist movement is doing, number one, the first book is called, is subtitled A Metamodern Guide to Politics, and it leads with personal vulnerability. It doesn't focus on high spiritual states. It focuses simply on how happy or sad or how miserable or joyful one is. And it brings it all into an accessible realm where the conversations that we actually can have with one another on a political level are framed by a developmental understanding. And I think that's terrific. I've had a chance to meet the authors of the book and virtually. And I think this is a very positive development in human culture, and that it's bringing something vital to bear. And I actually have some disagreements theoretically with the book. I don't think that it is 100% right on in every last detail. I think that it is, like every contribution, every perspective is both true and partial. Every advancing of our capacity to take perspectives takes us a little further, but it doesn't finish the process. So I will be moving ahead to do some additional work, and what I'll do in response specifically to you raising your hand right now is I will share on our Facebook group a series of links to a lot of different metamodernist resources that I think are worth us being aware of. Not everyone will have the energy and interest, but others that I've recommended this book to have begun reading it and are really getting benefit from it. And I would like to open up some other conversations that are not, many of them are explicitly metamodernist. Some, like the alternative parties in Denmark and the UK, are not exactly, but have something in common with the ethos. So I'm excited by what I see happening in culture, and I want to help serve it. So I'll help you participate in that as best I can. Thank you. That feels enough for now. And since I've taken as much time as I have, let's call on Annika.
Anyway, I was looking at my to-do list that evolved out of my studying the chapters 3 through 6. And it made me think that it might be helpful to have a little bit of a review. I think I was feeling a little lost. I understand that all of our inner work is work in progress, and also, but times are wasting. So it's good and it's necessary to begin our activism now, even before all of our foundational work is finished. And that's certainly true for me. So I'm wondering if you may have some advice to offer about how to organize our work on our inner work so that it serves to complement in the best way possible the outer work that we're already doing or that we're preparing to do. And my 5 topics so far that felt the most crucial for me to work on were develop a fundamental understanding of and relationship with wholeness, to create a good balance between inner work and outer work, to clarify my life purpose, to uncover my archetypal story, which I'm still not clear on how to do, and to identify areas of trauma work that still need attention. And I think that that's especially considering not only the personal trauma work, but also the implications of collective and cultural trauma. And I guess there's a lot more there. I certainly haven't done much work as far as collective or cultural trauma. And even, okay.
Yeah, well, that's a okay. Very rich, that's very rich. So let me, so, yes, exactly. So I think that the things that I most want to recommend that you do is to take up a morning practice of conscious movement and conscious stillness and, you know, a meditative practice. And that can be a short period of meditation. It doesn't have to be more than 10 minutes. And there's something about breathing and feeling and consciously exercising yourself in relation to the inherent radiance of being, the mystery of being, and the life force, and breathing and feeling and moving the body every day, and sitting and meditating and relaxing and opening to the mystery of being and the inherently divine and beautiful. That, do that. That's really important. And do a moments practice. In other words, in random moments, practice. Just intend to bring awareness, feeling, presence, care, curiosity, awakeness in some fresh way in the moment. You can do that with that breathing to and from the heart and feeling kind of a practice that I suggested. You can do it in a lot of different ways. But the idea of doing a moment's practice is really important. And I think that continuing to either spend time in a sangha or do readings or other things that build the profundity of your recognition of wholeness, divinity, the unbroken onlyness of being is also super important. And while we're doing this, let's also be waking up to our opportunity to make a difference, especially those of us in the United States right now. We can be volunteering, donating, engaging. There's a very important election going on and it needs our energy. So this is a moment that I'm teaching the course, and it's a moment when there's something at stake for a sizable proportion of the student body, even though we're an international crew. There are ways that this has relevance. I mean, there are things that people from other countries can do to affect our politics. I mean, that's a whole sidetrack. That's next week. Now, in terms of clarifying your life purpose and uncovering your archetypal story, I think just feeling, I don't think you have to do those things, actually. You know, the sense that you have a larger purpose and that something is calling to you is enough. And in a way, what's most important is that there is a deeper dimension of your being, your daimon. You know, like I tell this story, the myth of Ur, of how this is the story that mostly comes to us from the way that Plato recounts Socrates telling it, as he was waiting to drink the hemlock. And he described the story of this warrior, Ur, who had a near-death experience, or a death in, I guess, a death experience from which he was revived. He said, you go down to the underworld, you drink the waters of forgetfulness, Lethe, and then on the basis of your character, the fates come and they assign you your daimon, your guiding spirit. So on the basis of that, now you have the spirit of the next life. And Clotho, the spinner, she gives you the moment of your birth, and that includes everything we here in the West call heredity and environment. And So parents, rich, poor, peace, wealth, poverty, pimples, color of your hair, how tall, you know, thin, fat, whatever, all the things that are all of heredity and all of environment to some degree are cast by Clotho. It's your spindle destiny. She spins it into being. And then Lachesis, the one who assigned you your daemon, is also assigning to you the kind of magic, the what you attract, what you repel, your luck. She's the thrower of lots, the dice thrower. And then the final one is Atropos, she who cannot be turned, and she assigns the moment of your death. So this was cited by Hillman as part of his theory of soul. So what is important is to just, there is a daemon, there is a deeper dimension of your being, there is a soul quality that has a sense of how you can live this unique life of yours. And to some degree, during your whole life, you've gotten closer and closer to living your soul's nature fully, but it's never complete. We die without having completed that project. No matter how close you might be to death, somehow that soul quality is coming more fully into its expression right now in your life. So you could sort of pray for your soul to turn up the volume of his or her voice. You could ask for that deeper dimension of yourself to come forward more clearly. And as that happens, you'll find yourself noticing, my life purpose is this, or my archetypal story is that. And it'll be natural. But like thinking, I got to figure it out. Nah, I don't think we need to do that. The thing is, in the process, we'll suddenly discover, wait a second, I've got this quality, I just hasn't been coming online, and this is part of me. And a new energy will enter into you, and it'll be almost as though an archetypal being is flowing through you. And that is really cool. And that can come forward so powerfully that it's as if you begin to be, it's like a gambler on a lucky streak. It's like you can begin to magnetize the subtle energies of the world in such a way that you almost are for a while seeming like you're a magician. Generally, this never is permanent, but there are qualities that will come into being, and in some sense, you can allow the mystery to live you in a way that has a kind of miraculous and magical kind of a quality. That is what comes into being through this soul work ultimately. And then you brought up trauma. And I don't think that we need again to like, well, what are my traumas and how do I, because it's not as if trauma knows how to fix itself. What is necessary is this deep understanding of us as multidimensional beings who are affected by both personal and cultural traumas. And therefore, I think a profound heart of compassion and a deep kind of respect and a deep seeing into one's own being and the being of others, such that there's a kind of sober appreciation for the profundity of the healing work that is necessary in our world right now. And all of that personal work, of course, is co-arising with us discovering ways to be an ever more authentic and profound servant of being itself. More like, for me at this point, I know that I went through a period not too long ago where I became, I let in the heartbreaking truth more and more profoundly. And now I've been letting in the joy more and more profoundly for a period of time. And inevitably, the spiral will turn and it'll go more into the darkness and more into the light. And I'm deepened with every turn of the spiral. And we can be deepened together. And what we can do together in that dimension of practice, which is where we're heading after chapter 8, that'll be an interesting conversation. But we are here at the end of our time. So I want to thank you, Annika, for that really great question. I think that helped sum things up in a really useful way. So I'm really grateful to you. Thank you. And I'd like everybody to please open up your videos, open up your microphones, and let's all show up here together and make sure you're looking at the gallery view so we can see each other. Thank you so much, everyone.
Bye.
Lovely to be here.
Bye.
Bye. Wonderful. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye.
So long.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.